This is the NBC University of the Air. The program that was originally scheduled for this time, featuring Senators Tom Connally and Warren R. Austin on organizing for peace, has been postponed, and tonight a special broadcast will be heard. In the light of the sad events of this weekend, we have asked four members of the Foreign Affairs Committee of the House of Representatives to discuss the future of America's foreign policy, informally with Mr. Sterling Fisher, director of NBC's University of the Air. Mr. Fisher.
This is a sad occasion for all of us, but because of the tremendous importance of this country's foreign policy at this crucial time, the National Broadcasting Company has invited four members of the House Foreign Affairs Committee to come down to the studio to talk about the future of that policy. We are fortunate in having four congressmen from widely separated sections of the country in this group. Two are Democrats and two are Republicans. Not that that makes much difference in a time such as this. We are all here for one purpose, to clarify the issues as they face an American public in mourning for our late president. But first, let me introduce each of the congressmen and let them describe to you the impact of the president's death on official Washington and on the common people, the government clerks, and others of the nation's capital. First, Representative Luther A. Johnson of Texas, a ranking Democratic member of the Foreign Affairs Committee. Congressman Johnson, what was the reaction of the people with whom you work in Congress and the others of your acquaintance to the news that came out of Warm Springs Thursday evening?
Mr. Fisher, the president's death cast a gloom of sadness over Washington, and there was unfeigned sorrow on the part of everyone, congressmen, secretaries, pages, and elevator operators all showed evidences of their grief over the sudden tragic death of our great president, who is a casualty of this war.
Now, Representative John M. Voris of Ohio, one of the senior Republican members of the committee.
Mr. Fisher, among the Republicans, the president's death, it seemed to me, was greeted by a silence born of respect and sympathy. You know, he was our president, too. One thing that I noticed was so many comments on his tremendous courage in triumphing over his physical handicaps. And I believe that in the years to come, he will be an inspiration to the thousands, the possibly millions of handicapped men who come out of this war, and will give them courage to carry on and triumph in his spirit.
And Representative James P. Richards of South Carolina, how did you feel all about this, Mr. Richards?
Mr. Fisher, when the sad news came, I was at my home in Lancaster, South Carolina. The people were stunned and grief-stricken. All along the railway track to Washington, thousands were lined with sorrow on their faces and anxiety in their eyes. They knew that a great man and leader had departed. While at home, many asked anxious questions. One of them was, how about the new president? How will he measure up? What are his views on the international question of cooperation to preserve a just and lasting peace? I didn't hesitate to reassure them on that point.
And finally, one of the newest members of the committee, Representative Chester E. Merrill of New Hampshire.
Mr. Fisher, we were all greatly shocked and stunned when we heard the news of the president's passing. People could hardly believe the report. These are sad days for the United States and all liberty-loving people. The entire world has suffered an irreparable loss. The president was a casualty of this war. He actually worked himself to death fighting for liberty.
Yes, Mr. Merrill, and even persons who had been very critical of President Roosevelt during last fall's campaign felt as badly as the president's most loyal supporters. And this morning, when I saw the Guard of Honor escorting the President's casket up 15th Street and around the corner to the White House, I don't think there was a dry eye anywhere among the thousands who lined the street to pay their respects. But despite this testimony to our grief, there were those who felt no grief, but they were not Americans. The enemy's propagandists have tried to make capital out of this great tragedy. The Berlin Radio, according to today's papers, said, "But Truman is not Roosevelt, and domestic developments are possible in the U.S. which might also have their external consequences. Among these possibilities is perhaps not so much the war itself as the San Francisco Conference with its highly interesting paraphernalia, that is, the mutual relations of our enemies. Then the Japanese radio, which was not quite so optimistic, said, "No Japanese harbors any fond hopes for a sudden drop in the fighting power of America as a result of the death of President Roosevelt." In a broadcast directed to the Japanese people, it added, "We consider Roosevelt a very fortunate person indeed to have died before conditions became unfavorable and before things led to failure." Mr. Richards, what is the American answer to that?
Mr. Fisher, I think the best answer to the Tokyo reports and the Berlin reports along the line you have just read is the statement of the Secretary of State of the United States. Mr. Stettinius said, "There will be no change of purpose or break of continuity in American foreign policy under President Truman." He says, "When I say we are united in our resolve to give to President Truman our full support in the momentous task of carrying this war to a victorious conclusion and in establishing a secure peace under President Truman's leadership, we shall not falter either as a government or as a people in the accomplishment of these ends." Mr. Stettinius further said, "I know that I speak for all American people." He certainly speaks for me, and I believe he told the truth when he said he spoke for 130 million people.
Mr. Johnson, what does that answer of the Americas seem to you to be?
I think that the statement of Secretary Stettinius reflects the will of the American people and also reflects the will of President Truman. I think the best evidence of the fact that President Truman believes what Secretary Stettinius said is the record which he's made in the United States Senate as a senator from Missouri during the past 8 years, when we voted upon many questions involving our foreign policy, and on every vote in the Senate of the United States during the past 8 years, Senator Truman voted in favor of the policy of President Roosevelt with reference to all foreign policies.
Mr. Merrill, what does it seem to you will have to be the American policy now that we are faced with this new emergency?
I believe the American policy will be to create a just and lasting peace. In my opinion, we are united in our determination to develop a world organization to preserve the peace. Before becoming a member of Congress, and since I have been serving in the House of Representatives, I have repeatedly stressed the importance of constructing an international organization to prevent future wars. I am greatly pleased that President Roosevelt exercised far-sighted statesmanship in planning for the construction of an international organization for the purpose of preserving the peace. He intended to go to San Francisco, but although he cannot be there in body, he will be there in spirit. The greatest problem before us at the present time is the creation of world unity. World unity is imperative. The world has become small, and if civilization is to survive, then the nations must learn to live together. All parties are united in their desire to lay the foundations for a permanent peace, for a just and lasting peace, and that was showed when we voted overwhelmingly for the Fulbright resolution in the House and for the Connally resolution in the Senate.
Mr. Merrill has, Mr. Fisher has mentioned some things that I think Republicans could well remind the public at this time. Of course, there was a period back a few years ago when this country was not united on their foreign policy. But under the leadership and genius of the president, in which he not only led but reflected public opinion, we have arrived at a time where I think President Truman and Mr. Stettinius said accurately that there will be no change of purpose or break of continuity in our foreign policy. The Fulbright resolution originated in our House Foreign Affairs Committee. I, a Republican, happened to make the first speech in favor of it on the floor. Right after that, you will remember, came the Republican Mackinac Declaration. After that came the first international organization to be approved by Congress, UNRWA, and it received overwhelming bipartisan support. This year, when we put in limitations on post-war use of Lend-Lease, our star witness was President Roosevelt, and we quoted his words in arriving finally at an agreed limitation on the extension of Lend-Lease. Now, the President's plans for San Francisco show that he believes a time had come for an end to personal secret diplomacy, and had appointed a delegation who were to discuss in the open the problems of world security, and that American delegation had responsible representation from the Republican Party, the minority party. Therefore, I have great confidence that the result of the deliberations at San Francisco will be approved in the Senate when they come back, and in the Congress, and implemented for going forward in carrying out a just and lasting peace.
Mr. Johnson, what do you think is likely to happen in the Congress?
I think Mr. Voorhees is right. I think there is unity of the American people, and that there is no political differences between the parties with reference to our foreign policy. I think that's best evidenced by the fact that in our own committee, the Foreign Affairs Committee of the House, that, as Mr. Voorhees said, before Pearl Harbor there were some differences, but since there has been none, and every measure that's come before our committee has come with a unanimous vote of that committee. I would like to read, if I may, at this point.
Mr. Johnson,
yes.
Just before you go further on that, I wanted to call your attention to a thought that came to me. In talking to the American people, I have become convinced that they are almost 100% very much concerned and full of the desire that this world organization that has been proposed to preserve a just and lasting peace does go into effect. They realize that we have got to have cooperation between the nations of the earth to accomplish that dream. There's another angle to it, though, that I wanted to mention today, because a good many people are asking, how will the new president be able to work with Congress and to secure the cooperation of Congress? I mention that because the American people are educated to the fact, and they are fully informed about our Constitution and our laws, and they know that any proposed peace treaty or world or plan for world organization will go on the rocks, or cannot go into effect, I might say, unless it's ratified by the Senate of the United States. Now, the point that I want to reassure the American people on, and to let our enemies know, is that if you can judge the future by the past, that our new president will be able to work 100% with Congress. He will be able to work 100% with the Republicans and Democrats of the Senate. He's shown that already. He has many friends. Immediately after he went into office, he called into consultation leaders of the Senate, both Republicans and Democrats.
Mr. Richards, I hope what you have said will prove to be true. I'm just as certain as you are that the American people are demanding that we establish an international organization to preserve the peace. We must have, in order to do that, legislative, executive cooperation. The president must work with the Congress, and the Congress with the president. You have, in your opinion, voiced a hope that through that cooperation, we will be able to build the type of peace which we wish. And you believe that President Truman will be able, by working with the Congress, to secure ratification of the treaties that are going to be written at the cessation of hostilities.
Mr. Mayor, I'm convinced of that. He's shown preeminent qualities of leadership along that line already.
Well, Mr. Richards, isn't it your idea that he has already shown the type of American teamwork which secures cooperation in that He is willing to give and take and has shown that in his career in the Senate and as vice president. Isn't that right?
Mr. Boris, you're correct. He is not only willing to give and take, but he knows a president must give and take under our American system of government to accomplish his objective.
And don't you feel this, Mr. Richards, that at this critical time, it is a great thing for our country to have a man in the White House who has had experience on the Hill and knows how to get along with us folks down there on Capitol Hill?
There's no doubt about it, Mr. Flores.
The consensus, then, is that neither our will to prosecute the war nor our firm intention to establish a durable peace with a workable international organization to safeguard it is changed in the slightest by this week's events. In fact, I would gather from what you have said that our will to carry through to the objectives envisaged by President Roosevelt is stronger than ever because of our desire to make this a memorial to him.
You're right, Mr. Fisher. The Japs and the Germans have another guess coming if they think that the president's death is going to lessen our efforts in winning the war or minimize our efforts in winning the peace. At San Francisco, we'll be united. And while we'll miss the guiding hand and the voice of President Roosevelt, there will be, as Mr. Mara so well said, the spirit of President Roosevelt. And the last message that he gave in the afternoon press this evening is a speech which he wrote the night before he passed away. Its words are prophetic. It is almost like the last will and testament of the President of the United States. And I believe that if he had known that it was to be his last, he would have not changed a single word or syllable in that great speech, and I hope the American people read it. I would like to read just a few extracts from it, Mr. Fisher, if I may have time. He said in that speech, "We seek peace, enduring peace. More than an end to war, we want an end to the beginning of all wars. Yes, an end to this brutal, inhuman, and thoroughly impractical method of settling the differences between governments. We must go on to do all in our power to conquer the doubts and the fears, the ignorance, the greed which made this war possible. Today we are faced with the preeminent fact that if civilization is to survive, we must cultivate the science of human relationships. The work, my friends," said President Roosevelt in this undelivered speech, "is peace more than an end of this war, an end to the beginning of all wars. Yes, an end forever to this impractical, unrealistic settlement of differences between governments by mass killings of people. Today, as we move against the terrible scourge of war, as we go forward towards the greatest contribution that any generation of human beings can make in this world, the contribution of lasting peace, I ask you to keep up your faith. I measure the sound, solid achievement that can be made at this time by the straight edge of your own confidence and your resolve. And to you and all Americans who dedicate themselves with us in the making of an abiding peace, I say the only limit to our realization of tomorrow will be our doubts of today. Let us move forward with strong and active faith." Those words of President Roosevelt will live and will inspire those who meet in San Francisco when they go to make the framework of this great organization.
Mr. Johnson, I heard about that speech, and I want to say this. Of course, we all knew that these 300 Jefferson Day dinners that were to have taken place tonight were democratic affairs where the party in power was to get together and make medicine, as it were. And I wondered what sort of a message the president would send in wartime to these partisan groups. And when I saw this posthumous speech, which I picked up and read critically, I felt, just as you have expressed yourself, that this was indeed a worthy last will and testament and a message of faith and dedication, not only to Jeffersonian Democrats, but to Republicans, to all the people of this country and of other countries.
Mr. Voorhees, don't you think it's a wonderful tribute to the American system of government that in this hour of sadness, there seems to be no bitterness on the part of those who have disagreed personally and politically with the president in the past, and at leading Republicans and leading Democrats in this hour seem to have rededicated instead of slackening their efforts and their lives and their fortunes to the winning of this conflict, and they have restated their determination to see that everything possibly can be done both by the Republican and the Democratic parties of the United States hand in hand to perfect some kind of organization to see that this horror and bloodshed and strife won't come to the next generation.
Well, I thoroughly agree with you, Mr. Richards, and that the words were never said better than in that message that Mr. Johnson just read when the President Roosevelt said, "We must learn to put an end to this brutal, inhuman, and thoroughly impractical method of settling the differences between governments." We certainly have much to be thankful for in the spirit of unity with which we face the troubled times of the future.
The president's death may seal unity rather than to create disunity at this time.
Mr. Merrill, what did you think of that Jefferson Day speech?
Mr. Fisher, I'm very glad that that speech has been referred to here tonight. I call attention to two sentences. "Today we have learned in the agony of war that with great power there is involved great responsibility. We as Americans do not choose to deny our responsibility." The question might be asked, what is our responsibility at the present time? And it can be answered in this way. Our responsibility is to win the peace. The war is already won. I'm glad that it has been emphasized here tonight that the passing of the president does not mean a change in our foreign policy as far as the continuation of the war is concerned and as far as winning the peace is concerned. The president lived to see the dawn of victory. Under his leadership, a great navy was built. We have created the finest air force in the world and have brought into being a great and powerful army.
Mr. Merrill, now, could I put in a word there? I might call attention to the fact, too, that the new president has indicated his intention to follow the lines laid down by the departed president, to rest heavily upon the advice and to depend upon the military leaders of our armed forces to conduct this war.
Well, Mr. Richards, I'm glad that you have emphasized the policy as set forth by President Truman. We should be very happy that our gallant fighting men tonight are winning victories on every battlefront of the world. Now, we know that it is only a matter of time before our enemies will be destroyed, but the statesmanship of this republic and other nations must win the peace, building on the foundations that the late president has laid.
The President Roosevelt laid the foundation, and he laid the plans. He didn't wait until this war was over to start, as in the last war. The mistake we made in the last war was that we waited until the shooting ended before we made any efforts to plan for peace and to prevent another war. But this time, President Roosevelt begun immediately after Pearl Harbor to set up an organization by which this plan could be worked out so that another war would be prevented.
Mr. Johnson, don't you believe that what the president has done in laying the plans for the peace or for winning the peace will make it much easier to establish an international organization than it was after the last war?
Absolutely so, and he's planned so wisely and so well, and the details that he's made, the speech that he made, the address that he made to Congress at the beginning of the present session of Congress, he warned us of the dangers and the difficulties, but he said that after all, whether or not we had that rested with the people, and I believe the people have been inspired with the faith and the necessity that this must be done. And I do not believe that they will fail to carry on to a successful conclusion the plans and the foundation upon which he has built.
I have always felt that the problems in connection with winning the peace would be even more complex than the problems in connection with winning the war.
I think you're right.
Gentlemen, we should emphasize, though, that the American public opinion and American statesmen and the president of the great American republic can't do it all. We must have cooperation and a real give-and-take spirit from the other great nations of the world.
Well, Mr. Richards, Along that line, I think one thing that is worthy of comment in thinking about the plans that the president has led in formulating is the plan that he and Prime Minister Churchill and the others have worked out to take up this matter of peacemaking by not having all of our eggs in one basket. They have deliberately planned to have different organizations of limited powers to take up specific problems. For instance, UNRWA to take up relief, Bretton Woods to take up financial problems, San Francisco to take up security. We're going to have a food organization. I have heard from some of these leaders, and I know that you have too, in certain meetings that we were privileged to sit in on, where they didn't want to have everything rests on one single decision, but they wanted to have the world learn by doing and to have various organizations practice what the president called cultivating the science of human relationship.
That's right. All of these organizations are really a part of the plan to preserve peace. The Dumbarton Oaks is the central plan, but these other organizations will fit into it.
Mr. Voorhees, I think your main idea was that we all wanted to see the fruition of the great plan, but you were in favor of a situation that would not bring about the defeat of the master plan in case a segment of the American people would not agree to one phase of it.
Yes, Mr. Richards, you know there was a good bit of talk back a couple of years about somebody, the president or someone, having a blueprint of a world organization in their pockets to pull out and flash on the world. Well, we find this has happened, that this isn't merely a single blueprint, but it's a living, growing thing where we learn by experience, where we've made mistakes, we may in the future, but we learn by doing to cooperate and to take the necessary steps toward building a final overall organization that will someday prevent future wars and make this present sacrifice having not in vain.
May I just say this? Mr. Richards, you mentioned a few moments ago that the other nations would have to cooperate. That is true. But I think that this republic should take its place as a leader in peace as well as in the war and not try to remain isolated as we did after the last war.
Well, I want to thank you, gentlemen, for coming down to talk these things over with us and to express the very great pleasure we've felt in hearing you talk about these matters in the spirit of unity, which is required if we are to go forward to win not only the war, but peace. In a time of crisis, party lines fade, and we are all, first and foremost, Americans.
You have just heard another discussion on the future of our foreign policy as presented by the NBC University of the Air. In this special broadcast, we have presented four members of the Foreign Affairs Committee of the House of Representatives, Congressman Luther A. Johnson of Texas, James P. Richards of South Carolina, John M. Voris of Ohio, and Chester E. Merrill of New Hampshire. The moderator was Mr. Sterling Fisher, director of NBC's University of the Air. Next Saturday at the same time, Senators Pepper of Florida and Brewster of Maine will discuss the issues of foreign economic policy before Congress and their relation to the San Francisco Conference. Copies of these programs may be obtained by writing to the NBC University of the Air, National Broadcasting Company, Radio City, New York 20, New York. That's National Broadcasting Company, Radio City, New York 20. This program came to you from Washington.